Hello, and welcome to Light the Way with Dr. Colin Monger. He's the senior pastor of Shepherd of the Hills Calvary Chapel. At Light the Way, we believe the most powerful tool we possess when sharing our faith with others is the Word of God. It was the Apostle Paul that said, "Faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the Word of Christ." So as we open the Word together, it's our prayer that you'll not only receive what God has for you, but share what you learn with those you come in contact with. And now, here's Pastor Colin.
Well, with that, if you would turn your Bibles this morning to Matthew chapter 10. Matthew's Gospel, chapter 10. Notice what it says beginning in verse 16. "Behold, I'm sending you out as sheep in the midst of wolves, so be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. Beware of men, for they will deliver you over to courts and flog you in their synagogues, and you will be dragged before governors and kings for my sake to bear witness before them and the Gentiles. When they deliver you over, do not be anxious how you are to speak or what you are to say, for what you are to say will be given to you in that hour. For it's not you who speak, but the Spirit of your Father speaking through you. Brother will deliver brother over to death, and the father his child, and children will rise against parents and have them put to death, and you will be hated by all for my name's sake. But the one who endures to the end will be saved. When they persecute you in one town, flee to the next. For truly, I say to you, you will not have gone through all the towns of Israel before the Son of Man comes. A disciple is not above his teacher, nor a servant above his master. It is enough for the disciple to be like his teacher and the servant like his master. If they have called the master of the house Beelzebul, how much more will they malign those of his household? So have no fear of them, for nothing is covered that will not be revealed or hidden that will not be known. What I tell you in the dark, say in the light, and what you hear whispered, proclaim on the housetops. And do not fear those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Rather fear him who can destroy both soul and body in hell. Are not two sparrows sold for a penny, and not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your father? But even the hairs of your head are all numbered. Fear not, therefore, you are of more value than many sparrows. So everyone who acknowledges me before men, I will also acknowledge before my Father who is in heaven. But whoever denies me before men, I also will deny before my Father who is in heaven." This morning, I want to talk about a peace worth fighting for. It's actually the second part of a two-part message we started last week in this passage. In Matthew 5, Jesus says something that every police officer knows. He says, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called sons of God." I've always noticed how Jesus did not say peacekeepers. He said peacemakers. In other words, making peace, literally between you and other people, between people and people, between people and God. It's building bridges, it's making connections, it's building relationships, mending fences. That's peacemaking. And sometimes you will be making peace where conflict exists. Could be somebody that you're at odds with, someone in your family, someone in your life, or maybe it's two people who just aren't seeing eye to eye and they're not talking very well. Or maybe even you're making peace between people and their family or people and their children sometimes. You will sometimes make peace that way. But oftentimes we find ourselves making peace between people and God. And that's exactly what Jesus did. He built a bridge from the world to heaven, and he made peace between a fallen human race and a holy, righteous God. That's why Jesus says, "Blessed are the peacemakers, they will be called sons of God," because that's exactly what the Son of God did. And when you do that kind of work, people look at you and they see the same things that they saw when Jesus was walking in ministry. And if you think about it, how did Jesus make peace? How did it happen? Well, it didn't happen through violence, and it didn't happen through overthrowing a government or marching on some city. It didn't happen by leading a revolt or encouraging people to break the law and fight the police. It didn't happen by sowing discord. You know, Jesus didn't even encourage people to not pay their taxes. And I think that's something most of us could get behind, to be honest with you, if he had had that message, you know, don't worry about your taxes. But he didn't. In fact, you remember the time the apostles needed to pay their tax and they didn't have it. And he said, no, go to that fish. The money you need will be there. Or what about the other time when people asked him, is it right for us to pay taxes to Caesar? And Jesus picked up a coin and he said, well, whose face is on it? And they said, Caesar's. And he said, well, give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar and give to God what belongs to God. Jesus made peace in the world, but he didn't do it through trying to overthrow the institution. He made peace by taking the gospel to people's hearts. Later in the book of Acts, the apostles are doing the same thing. They're walking around, they're preaching, they're in the cities, they're in the streets, they're in the synagogues. And somebody accuses them and they say, hey, these are the men who have turned the world upside down. And again, they didn't do it through violent revolution. They did it through sharing the gospel message. That's how peace is made, by letting the gospel transform the heart of the person and that manifesting itself in the world. And that is the mission that Jesus sends all of us on. He says to go into the world and preach the gospel. And that's the mission that he's sending his apostles on. You remember back in verse 7, he said, and proclaim as you go, saying, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. And just like any mission, there are some things to keep in mind when you're out there doing the work. And last week, we talked about three of those. First of all, Jesus told them to exercise caution. You remember in verse 16 where he said, I'm sending you as sheep in the midst of wolves, so be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. Be careful when you go out there because not everybody is going to have your best interest at heart. Second, he said, expect opposition. There will be people who oppose you. They oppose Jesus. They oppose the prophets and the Beatitudes. Jesus said, if you're persecuted for my name's sake, you're in good company, for so they persecuted the prophets before you. He said back in verse 17, beware of men, that they'll deliver you over. They'll flog you. They'll accuse you. They'll drag you into the courts and the synagogues. So expect opposition. Third, we saw anticipate provision. When you serve the Lord, he will give you what you need to do what he's called you to do. In verse 19, he said, when you get there and they are persecuting you, don't worry about what you're going to say in the moment. It will be given you in that hour. God will provide you what you need. This week, I want to look at three more pieces of advice that Jesus gives his disciples as he sends them on this work. First of all, accept redirection. Things will hardly go the way you anticipate them going. Second, possess determination. Sometimes you're going to have to push through. And third, have a public confession ready. Be in a position to share your faith. Notice what it says in verse 21. Brother will deliver brother over to death, and the father his child, and children will rise against parents and have them put to death. And you will be hated by all for my name's sake. But the one who endures to the end will be saved. You know, I will confess to you, that is not what people usually have in mind when training or preparing for some kind of ministry work. That's probably not the pep talk you're going to get when you're on your way out the door to a mission trip. That's probably not what we're going to tell students the first day of confirmation or seminary or high school or Sunday school, because it just doesn't sound very encouraging, does it? I mean, it's all about being delivered over to death and having to endure all of this until the very end, that it's never going to go away. That's not really the type of motivational talk that riles up a crowd to go off and serve. But the reality is, ministry is hard. Being a Christian is hard. Serving the Lord in your life, however it is he calls you, will be hard. I shared with you a couple weeks ago the statistics of pastors who typically in America stay in a church about 3 or 3.5 years. 4 years is the high end of the range. You get to 5 years and you have broken the mold. And this is oftentimes why. In fact, it's been studied. Pastors have been interviewed. Why did they leave so quickly? And they'll say, because it was a lot harder than they thought it would be. In fact, there are studies that show a good percentage of seminary graduates will not finish 2 years in ministry before they hang it all up and go right back to a secular job. And they say, because it's hard. Because this type of language isn't on the recruiting poster for a seminary program. This isn't the first day of orientation in your Master of Divinity course. And what happens is they go through seminary and they get built up and pumped up and they get out to the first church and it's hard. And they weren't mentally prepared. I remember when I enlisted in the Marine Corps, my recruiter said, oh, boot camp, you know what? People talk a lot about it, especially guys that get out of boot camp and they want to make it sound a lot worse than it really was because they want to seem a lot tougher, but you'll get there. It's doable. People do it every day. Don't believe everything you hear. And I said, okay, that sounds reasonable. And what did I do? I went home and I watched a movie on Vietnam where the first half of the movie is Marine Corps basic training. And they're yelling at these people and they're screaming and there's mud and there's bleeding and there's crying and there's running and there's throwing things. And I went back to my recruiter and I said, is that what I'm in for? And he said, that's Hollywood. You have to understand, that's a movie. That isn't reality. And so, no, that's not what it's going to be like. And I said, okay. Until I got there. And I realized that Hollywood, in that particular case, had been more honest about what it was going to be like than my recruiter. He was a great salesman. But the reality of boot camp was there was yelling and screaming and throwing things and bleeding and crying and the strongest guys just breaking down. I came to learn later that movie I had watched starred a man as the drill instructor who was a real-life Marine Corps drill instructor, and he made it to be exactly the way he would put recruits through training. And you get into that, and there's this sort of shock. You know, you're all hyped up. There's all the hugs at the airport, and okay, we'll see you in a little while. And you fly off, and you go to the USO office, and everyone's, well, thank you so much for being willing to serve. And, you know, there's a special room, and you go and you have the comfortable seat. And then someone comes in, they said, if you're going to basic training, the ride's out front. Come on, guys. And so you get up and you go, and you get on the bus. They turn off the lights. You put your head between your knees, and you stay that way for about an hour and a half till you get to the base. The first voice you hear is your drill sergeant coming onto the bus, yelling as loud as he can to get off the bus in 10 seconds. Well, it doesn't happen. It goes miserably, and it is a shock to the system. And the truth is, in some ways, living a Christian life can be like that. There's plenty of people in the world who will tell you it's going to be easy and roses and that there's going to be nothing but good times and sunshine ahead. And not just in pastoral ministry, but in any personal Christian walk. The reality is it's hard. The reality is it's hard to be different. It's hard to stand out. It's hard to go against the flow. It's hard to be the stick in the mud. It's hard to resist temptation in a world that tells you you deserve that. It's hard to go the other way when popular opinion is going against you. And I think one of the hardest parts of a Christian life is just how things often change and how suddenly they can. How you have a certain idea of the way things should look and then they go differently. Or you have an idea about how life should go and it takes an unexpected turn. You know, there's an old Yiddish proverb out there that says, we plan, God laughs. And I think that's very true for many of our lives. Now, with that in mind, the first thing I want to draw your attention to this morning is accept redirection. Sometimes, well, oftentimes, things will rarely go as you have planned. Usually, they diverge in some way. Notice what it says in verse 23. He says, when they persecute you in one town, so you have this idea, you're going to go to this town, you're going to minister, you're going to preach, people are going to be saved. You get there, lo and behold, they persecute you in the town. What does he say? Flee to the next. Be willing to accept redirection. You know, in the book of James, it says, woe to you who say, today or tomorrow we go into such and such a city and we're going to spend a year there and trade and make a profit. Yet he warns us, you don't know what tomorrow will bring. Instead, he says, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we're going to do this or that. The point is, we have no idea what's coming next. We can have plans and calendars and schedules all day long, but we have no idea what's coming tomorrow. You might have a plan that you're going to live in a certain town or take a certain job or go into a certain career or buy a certain home or marry somebody or not marry anybody. And sometimes we can have all these plans for life and then God comes along at just any given moment and redirects it all. And so James says, plan, that's fine. Don't worry about that. You can make plans, but do it with the disclaimer, if the Lord wills. Yeah, I'll be there tomorrow, if the Lord wills. Yeah, I can make it next weekend, if the Lord wills. Yeah, we're going to do this next year, if God wills. It's an attitude of being willing to accept redirection. You know, I'll admit I never wanted to be a pastor. It wasn't on my radar. I was like most people in America, I think, and I believed that the pastor worked 1 hour a week, had the cushiest job. I didn't think it was full time. They showed up, they talked a little bit. We all went home to Sunday lunch, and you know what? That was a pastor's life. I never thought it was something that could be full time, that could be 60 hours a week. I never understood that. You know what I wanted to be when I was a kid? A baseball player. And then a race car driver, and then an artist, and then a pilot. Then I went to the military. Then I went and became a cop. Then I worked in construction. Then I tried to open my own business, which didn't go very well. And then one day, God got a hold of me and says, you're doing it all wrong. I want you to go in another direction. And he redirected my life in a wonderful way. That will happen. God has a habit of doing that, of sending curveballs your way. Think of Noah for just a minute. You know, this guy just living his life. And then one day the Lord shows up and says, Noah, there's going to be a big flood, and I need you to go tell everybody and build this ark. It's going to take you 100 years to build it, but I want you to do it because there's going to be a flood and I'm going to wipe everything out. And I can just imagine Noah going, but Lord, it hasn't even rained yet. What do you mean a flood? This is the longest drought in, well, since ever. We've never had rain. And then God says, don't worry, you'll have all the rain you need. I'm going to flood the world. I need you to build the ark. And then everything about Noah's life changed. Or what about David's life? A small shepherd boy, not even big enough to wear proper armor, just hanging out in the field playing games. Then one day God says, yeah, David, get up and get your slingshot and a couple little rocks. And I want you to go fight that big guy named Goliath over there because the fate of the whole war is going to rest on your shoulders. And if you can take him down, then, the Israel army is going to win. The Philistines will become the slaves. And so, David, you go slay Goliath because I'm trying to prove a point here. And then after that, by the way, David, you're going to become a general in Israel, and then you're going to be the servant of the king of King Saul, who's going to turn on you out of jealousy. You're going to spend some time in exile until eventually you become king, and then you're going to be there, and you're going to make some terrible mistakes, but eventually I'm going to make you a promise that no king will ever come to Israel who doesn't come from your line. And so, David, all that's in your future. I want you to go fight Goliath. That's a whole different way that his life went. Or what about Mary for just a minute? Think about her getting ready for the biggest party of her life, her wedding day, getting ready to be Mrs. Joseph the Carpenter. You know, like two camels in the garage and a couple of kids running around, living in Nazareth. And then one day the angel shows up and says, no, Mary, everything's going to go differently. You're going to be the mother of the Son of God. What about you? What about your life? Can you think of a time when God changed your life? He sent you in a direction you didn't plan, that you never envisioned? Or maybe it hasn't happened yet and you're making plans. You're going to go to a school. You're going to go into some kind of career. You're going to answer some kind of calling. And you have it all picked out and you know exactly what you're going to do. That's great. Make plans if the Lord wills. Be flexible. Be ready to pivot because things will rarely go according to plan. Sometimes you think you're going to one town and you end up fleeing to the next. And so anticipate redirection. Second, possess determination. Because things will not go as planned, be prepared to push through the difficulty. Notice in verse 26, so have no fear of them. For nothing is covered that will not be revealed, or hidden that will not be known. What I tell you in the dark, say in the light, and what you hear whispered, proclaim on the housetops. And do not fear those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Fear rather the one who can destroy both body and soul in hell, he says. You know, there's something to keep in mind about the enemy of your faith, and you have an enemy of the faith. His name is Satan. In the Bible, he's called Lucifer. He's a fallen angel. He is the enemy of God, sentenced to an eternity in hell, and he's trying to bring as many people with him as he possibly can, and that includes anybody who picks up the mark of Jesus Christ. And so there is an enemy, and he has weapons in this world and people in this world. But there are some things to keep in mind about that enemy. He is only as powerful in your life as you allow him to be. Think about that for a minute. Satan has only as much power in your life as you're willing to give him. And here's what I mean by that. It's not some prosperity hype. Satan will affect your life to the degree that you allow it. Sure, he can throw problems your way. He can send difficult people your way. He can take things away from you that you really needed and were depending on. But that will affect you to the degree that you allow it. Jesus tells us in John's gospel, no one will be able to take your joy from you. And yet, how often do we just give it up? Because things aren't going the way we planned, we're just going to get bitter. Because things didn't work out the way we had hoped, we're going to get discouraged. Satan might be able to take things from you, but he cannot take you. Jesus says here in verse 28, so have no fear. Do not fear those who kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. You remember Job, the most righteous man in all the world, and God was bragging about him one day, and Satan was there, and they were having this dialogue, which is a really interesting thing to think about, that Satan and God were conversing, but Satan basically said, you know, he only loves you because you give him everything he wants. Let me take it away. He's going to curse you to your face. And so God said, you know what? No, he won't. And so I'm going to let you do this, but you can't kill him. You can't mess with him or too much, but you can take everything else. And so Satan goes. And he took a lot from Job. He took his home and his animals, his children, his financial security, his health. He even took the support of his own wife when Job's wife looks at him and says, just curse God and die and get it over with. But no matter how hard he tried, he couldn't take Job. Because Job's response was, the Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Doesn't sound like a man who had lost or surrendered his joy. Or what about the Apostle Paul sitting in a Roman jail cell waiting to be seen by Caesar, knowing that Caesar could just order him to be executed and that'd be the end of it. They took his freedom. They took him from his home. He suffered physically. He was abused and beaten and stoned and stabbed and shipwrecked. And everywhere he went, he was rejected. And yet after all of that, earning him a nice cushy spot in a Roman custody, he writes a letter to the Philippian church saying, complete my joy. In the book of Ephesians, it says to put on the armor of God and withstand the schemes of the devil. In James 4, it says, if you resist the devil, he'll flee from you. It wouldn't say that if it wasn't possible. Now, that isn't to say it's easy all the time, but it is possible. And so you're going to have to possess determination. Commit yourself to a righteous resistance. Be willing to be different, to stand out, to go against the grain. Something else to keep in mind about your enemy. You might resist him in this life, but you should know he is a defeated enemy. God promised in Genesis 3, after Adam and Eve were tempted to sin, and they did, and they fell, that one day the offspring of Eve would rise up and crush the head of the serpent. Well, that happened on the cross. And on the cross, Satan was defeated. And because of that defeat, his power becomes a sort of illusion, and he knows it. And so Jesus says here, do not fear those who can kill the body, but they can't do anything to the soul. And that is his number one weapon of choice, fear. Intimidation. Satan's a bully. And like any bully, the more power you give him in your life, the more power he will take. But also like any bully, he's more bark than bite. And when you realize that, Jesus says you have no fear. So then somebody asked me, okay, if he has no power, no real power in this world, explain everything that we see. Explain things like war and chaos and fear and abuse and explain that mass shooting that just happened yesterday in New York, and explain all the hunger and all the issues we see in the world. If he has no real power, how come he's able to mess with so many things? And the answer is just simply speaking, you're looking at the throes of death of a defeated enemy. And there are few things in life more aggressive than an animal in the throes of death. In fact, every year hunters go out in the fall and they see that prized buck and they take a shot and it's the one they've been waiting on their whole life, and they run up too soon and the animal isn't dead and it thrashes. And in many cases each year, hunters are killed that very way. On the cross, Jesus said, "It is finished." And when it was finished, he fulfilled that promise in Genesis 3. And from that point forward, Satan is under a sentence of death. He's not going to be the king in hell. He's the primary occupant. He's inmate number one. He's the first convict in hell. And he wants to take as many people with him as possible. But make no mistake about it, he is defeated in this world. In 1 John 4, it says, "You're from God and you overcame them, and he who is in you is greater than he who's in the world." With that in mind, understand you're going to have to be determined. Just because Satan has no eternal power doesn't mean he can't somehow get in your way and try to make you stumble in this life. And so you're going to have to push forward, to push through it all. In the book of Philippians, Paul writes and he says that everything that happened to him happened to further the gospel. And in the Greek language, and I've made much of this over time, it implies this furthering against opposition, much like a boat pushing against the current going out to sea. Paul says, in that same way, the gospel has been furthered against the opposition of the world. And everything that happened to him, including his persecution, his arrest, rejection after rejection, has happened to further the gospel in the world. And so you're going to have to be determined. You're going to have to keep going to understand that your greatest enemy will be your own fear. And so Jesus says, "Have no fear of them. Do not fear those who kill the body but can't kill the soul." And so accept redirection, possess determination. Third, and we finish with this, have a public confession. Notice in verse 32, "So everyone who acknowledges me before men, I also will acknowledge before my Father who's in heaven. But whoever denies me before men, I also will deny before my Father who is in heaven." One of the most powerful tools you will ever possess in your walk with the Lord, in your fight in this world, and your carrying out the mission that Jesus has put you on, is going to be your personal testimony. In 1 Peter 3, it says to always be prepared to give a defense. And literally what it means is to share with people your personal story. Be ready to explain why you believe what you believe, and what God has done in your life and what you've been saved from and how he's provided for you over the years and how he's directed and guided you. I'll give you an idea of just how powerful a personal testimony can be. The most famous psalm we know in the world, Psalm 23, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want," is the testimony of David as a very old man looking back on his life at how God led him through every challenge, through every defeat, and always knowing that even through all of that, through the valley of the shadow of death, he even says, God was always with him. And he ends with, "I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever." It's a testimony that we use and we encourage people with. And just like that, your testimony is a powerful tool. What has God done in your life? What's God given you? How's he saved you? How's he moved? How have you seen him work? Stories of how he came in right when you needed him the most. And so Jesus says, to do that, acknowledge me before men. I'll acknowledge you before my Father who is in heaven.
You've been listening to Light the Way with Dr. Colin Munger, the senior pastor of Shepherd of the Hills Calvary Chapel. If you'd like to hear this message again, stop by our website at lightthewayradio.org. Not only will you find an archive of Pastor Colin's teachings there to listen to, but there you can find out more about our ministry. Jesus said, "You are the light of the world," and we want everything we do and say to revolve around that. If you'd like to get behind what we're doing, please visit lightthewayradio.org. Thank you for listening today, and come back next week as Dr. Colin Monger once again delivers another helpful message from God's Word to help us light the way. In the meantime, remember to be a light to someone this week.